Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Here in Washington, as Joe mentioned, town has gotten a little less crowded as the Senate has now headed out for effectively a two-week break. They won't be back until July 13th. Nothing left to vote on and perhaps nothing left to celebrate, as they thought they were going to be celebrating yesterday in the Capitol, a signing of the bipartisan housing bill that passed both chambers with massive bipartisan majorities. It got 85 votes in the Senate. And yet it did not get, yet at least, the signature from President Trump, who, of course, yesterday canceled that planned signing because he wants to see the Save America Act pass first, which raises the question as to whether and when he does intend on signing the housing bill at some point. He was asked about that in the Oval Office yesterday afternoon.
I said I'm not signing the housing bill. I want to see what happens. We said, look, the housing bill is... I made billions of dollars with housing. I know housing better than anybody, maybe anywhere. It's all about the interest rate. Lower the interest rates, you can have all the housing you want.
Lower the interest rates. Of course, that's what he would love the Federal Reserve to start doing. And it's been made more difficult by the rise in prices reaffirmed today in economic data with a four handle still on the PCE. But we want to get to the matter at hand with regard to this legislation. It has not been sent to the president yet, to our understanding. Therefore, he could take some time. In fact, all the time he wants until it's transmitted to the White House. Then he'd have 10 days to sign it before it automatically became law. Unless, again, he decided to veto it. Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall joins us now live from the White House with the latest on this. Tyler, the Speaker of the House is on his way to meet with the president about an hour from now. Can he turn this around?
Well, Joe, he's definitely going to try to. We heard from the House Speaker Mike Johnson yesterday seeming to indicate that they're going to try to take some provisions from the SAFE Act and tie it into a reconciliation package, which, as you both well know, would mean that potentially that legislation could get through with just a simple majority. It would pass on a partisan basis alongside party lines. But we're already starting to hear from some Republicans that that path may not be so easy, as some of those more fiscally conservative members, if you will, have raised concerns about passing a reconciliation 3.0. They say that they would need to see full pay-fors in any such package, which could prove problematic, as we've seen with previous reconciliation packages. So this isn't going to be so cut and dry or easy. Plus, also, Joe and Kaylee, that raises, of course, always the prospect that we could see lawmakers start to tack on some other priorities. Once you start a reconciliation bill, it is very hard to keep it on the slim and narrow. That means that that could spark some other debates, which could ultimately derail the timeline, because we know that President Trump wants to see this as soon as possible. Originally, he had said July 4th. It appears difficult that they're going to make that timeline, but House Speaker Mike Johnson is definitely coming over here to the White House to try to continue the conversation with President Trump after quite a contentious meeting with his colleagues in the upper chamber yesterday.
Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall live at the White House a day after the president's meeting with the NATO Secretary General. The Oval Office has been a busy place lately. Following that meeting involving the future of NATO, the president's commitment to Ukraine, what's happening with regard to the war with Iran, Mark Rutte, the Secretary General, made his way to our cameras on the North Lawn, right where Tyler was standing, for an exclusive conversation. Here's what he said.
What I believe is to be fair when leadership is successful. His leadership is successful. And what I wanted to show today is it is successful in three ways. One on Iran, degrading nuclear capability. Two on NATO, not only getting the allies to deliver, to commit to 5% defense spending, but also to deliver on the spending. And that's clearly what is happening at the moment. And third, by taking that code, that mantle of being the leader of the free world. And when he meets in Ankara, he will meet with all the allies, but also 10 countries there as guests from the Middle East, from the Indo-Pacific, a total combined GDP of $70 trillion, 2.5 the size of the United States, absolutely there to hear his views, to get his thoughts on the next steps we collectively have to take.
Well, of course, the financial aspect of this and the investments into the defense industrial base are one part of it, Mr. Secretary General. But there's also the consideration of actual human capital and U.S. military forces that are currently stationed all around Europe. Obviously, we've now seen withdrawals and considerations that this administration is making about moving troops around further. How do you avoid anything being chaotic in nature as that plays out? And how does Europe make sure that it's able to adequately defend himself itself in a surprise scenario? What are those preparations like?
I think the United States is doing that. So let's first agree that the United States has to take care of multiple theaters, not only Europe, also, for example, the Indo-Pacific. And if a situation would occur where they have to defend both sides of the equation, both the Indo-Pacific and Europe, they have to avoid a situation in which they have spread their resources too thinly. This is why Europeans have to step up. This is NATO 3.0, a stronger Europe and a stronger NATO.
NATO 3.0 is the message from its Secretary General Mark Rutte, who just spoke with us yesterday on Balance of Power, exclusively after his meeting with President Trump in the Oval Office. And now for a reaction to what he told us and what that meeting perhaps portends for the NATO summit happening in Turkey in just a few weeks, we turn to a former NATO ambassador, Kay Bailey Hutchison, who, of course, was the U.S. ambassador to NATO, also a former Republican senator from Texas. Ambassador, welcome back to Bloomberg TV and radio. We were all speaking in advance of the Secretary General's visit about what a tough job he may have had ahead of him in trying to message to this president the importance of the U.S. Maintaining its alliance with this alliance, with the importance of the allies. He even brought charts, a poster board presentation to underscore the commitments the alliance is making financially to the defense industrial base. Do you believe that's enough for this president, for this administration?
Thank you, Kaylee, for having me. I do think the president is certainly looking at this. And I think the G7 was a good beginning for preparation for the NATO summit, because I think that the importance of the alliance for the long term for our own country's security, when we are facing potential adversaries in Asia, Asia Pacific, in the Middle East, we need allies. And I think the president was rightly disappointed when we were trying to hold down the nuclear capability of Iran, and some of our NATO allies did not allow us to use airspace or even bases that we join in paying for. I think the president was concerned about that. I hope, and what I'm looking for the summit, is that we would now come together, as it seemed happened in the G7, and say, okay, for the long term, we're stronger together.
Until recently, until yesterday, Ambassador, the president's been referring to NATO as a paper tiger. Did this meeting yesterday save the alliance as we know it?
I think everyone that is tuned in here believes that NATO is a very important alliance, that we do so much interoperability with our NATO allies, of our airplanes, our intel sharing, all of those things are important that we do together. I don't think NATO is a paper tiger. I think NATO is a very strong and important alliance in the security of our country. And I think the members of Congress agree with that in the main and are supportive of helping our NATO allies and to keep us strong. Does that mean that we wouldn't move troops around? Yes, we will. I'm sure that's what the president is saying. But I don't think it's going to be any kind of an abandonment of NATO. And in fact, I hope that this NATO summit with all of the heads of state, including our Asia Pacific partners, will strengthen the alliance.
Well, as we consider what may come of the summit, are you expecting, Ambassador, any firm, tangible deliverables, either for the members of the alliance or even a country that is not Ukraine?
I certainly think there will be discussions of Ukraine. That is Europe's most important priority because it's so close. And I think the president is getting weary, should have been weary a long time ago, of Russia's dangling peace agreements and then not coming through. I think Russia is I think we should have more sanctions on Russia, and I think we should help end this. And I think that will be a major topic of the summit, which is in all of our interests to help Ukraine end this ridiculous invasion of their sovereign nation.
Well, so tell us more about that, Ambassador. What would be your advice? How do we end this now? Is it by providing more weapons directly to Ukraine? Is it intelligence? Is it what we're already doing?
All of the above. I think more, I think we do share intelligence. I think we should be doing everything possible to help them get more of the drones that have been so successful. Now that they have perfected it on their own, the Ukrainians are making headway with, they have a right to do that. I think we should be helping them and
We're having a little bit of trouble with your connection, Ambassador, but we appreciate your thoughts on Ukraine, knowing, of course, and as the ambassador was alluding to earlier, Joe, that we heard from the president at the G7 summit in France that he would like to shift his attention to Ukraine and ending the war between Ukraine and Russia once this Iran situation obviously resolved, though that is still very much a work in progress. We got the memorandum of understanding, a final deal, though. Still has many weeks to be negotiated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, there's only so many patriots to go around right now, as we have also learned with a lot of players around the world, including Israel, looking to replenish their stocks of defensive missiles. But we also know that the president likes to align himself with a winner. We've heard that a lot of times over the last couple of days, and it does appear, and we'll hear about this on Twitter as soon as we say it, that the tide may be turning with Ukraine reaching deeper into Russia and really inflicting some serious damage by using drones that are being built in people's garages. It's a pretty remarkable moment.
Yeah, and we asked the Secretary General, Mark Rutte, about that yesterday, whether or not any allies had concerns about Ukraine striking deeper into Russian territory. His answer was basically no. Ukraine deserves to defend itself. And they're, of course, happy to see Ukraine advancing where it can. And on that note, Ambassador, as we've reestablished your connection, when you consider, Joe just mentioned the need for Patriot missile systems, for example, but the idea that there is not ample supply necessarily when we have all of these different theaters that require our attention. How concerned are you that potentially the funding isn't going to be there? As we know that there has been supplemental funding requests now sent to Congress to fund in part our war effort in Iran and look at our stockpiles. And it doesn't seem like there's massive appetite to acquiesce to that request for the Congress to pass it.
Kaylee, it's a good question. I think every time Congress has voted for help for Ukraine, for instance, that has passed, and it has been significant just recently. But we do need a bigger arsenal, that's for sure. We use a lot on Iran, and we certainly have been helpful to Ukraine. We hope the Europeans will step up also to help us as we help Ukraine. And I think we could do more for Ukraine, and I think we could do more to tamp down Russia. I think it is time, and I think the president has shown that he is very frustrated with Russia and that we need to help Ukraine in this. And I think that can be done with more sanctions and more of a grip on Russia, but also helping Ukraine finish the job.
Ambassador, we've only got about a minute left. I'd love for you to just reach back to your old Senate cap for a moment and reflect on what took place yesterday as the president had a pretty tough conversation with the Republican caucus in the Senate about a range of issues, including Iran, the war powers vote, which he apparently turned around within the day yesterday, but also the Save America Act, the housing bill that he's put on ice. Is the president being fair to the Senate majority leader?
Well, I think the worst thing that the Senate did was ever showing no support for the Iranian situation while we are in a very delicate negotiation. That was just short-sighted. And I was glad that the president showed what he had to the Senate to do that. The Senate certainly has... The Senate and the House are at loggerheads right now, and it is time for them to work together going forward on these very important issues. Certainly the Save America Act is so important. The housing, I think, is important, but it can be negotiated a bit, make it even stronger.
Kate Bailey Hutchison, thank you, Ambassador, for the insights. I'm sorry we're out of time.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm Kaylee Lyons alongside Joe Matthew here in Washington, where we continue the analysis, the postmortem on the primaries that happened in New York earlier this week, in which a number of progressive candidates backed by the Democratic Socialist Mayor Zohran Mamdani won their primaries, in two cases ousting more moderate incumbents in those seats, or at least less to the left than some of these Democratic socialists. This is a debate we had on the program yesterday, if you heard our conversation with New York Republican Congressman Mike Lawler. But you're continuing to see more evidence of the wind shifting, perhaps, in certain portions of the Democratic Party, and a break from what Democratic leadership wants versus what others are pursuing here. And the AP now reporting, Joe, interestingly, that Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland is now backing Abdul El-Sayed in the Michigan Senate race. Of course, it's a three-way race between him, Mallory McMorrow, and Congresswoman Haley Stevens. Haley Stevens is the one backed by leadership Chuck Schumer. Yep. And yet Van Hollen's choice is El-Sayed, who, of course, also has the endorsement of the likes of Bernie Sanders. Once again, progressive versus moderate. In which way does the party want to be going?
This is why we heard from Scott Bessent and other Republicans yesterday. Yeah. So this isn't just a Manhattan phenomenon. Look at Maine. Yeah, look at Michigan. Look at what happened in California. And there are other examples. The president calls them communists. They are self-described socialists, democratic socialists, who have become a significant part of this party, helped in part by Bernie Sanders. This is interesting for Van Hollen, of course, a progressive from Maryland, but also an establishment Democrat who's been in the mix for a lot of years here. So we hadn't had a chance to get to Jeannie on this, which I'll be very curious to hear. The question is, do we have a national trend underway? Are the cross currents actually what they appear to be? We're still stuck in primary season.
Yeah, well, of course, at least on the Republican side, they're suggesting that this is showing directionally where the Democratic Party is headed. Mm-hmm. That's actually what President Trump said in the Oval Office yesterday in reaction to New York's results.
Well, they're going radical left. They're going really, you know, you talk about the Democrat socialists. It's really communist. He picked three. They won. They beat a guy named Dan Goldman. He's a pretty liberal guy. When they go more liberal than Dan Goldman, they're really into Never Never Land.
Bring in our panel now, and we've got a good one today. Bloomberg Politics contributor Jeannie Shanzano, our Democratic analyst and democracy visiting fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Ash Center, alongside Republican strategist Katie Frost, back today, the political director of the American Principles Project. Ladies, great to have both of you with us, and thank you. What do you make of this conversation, Jeannie? You're not only coming from New York, but I don't know, are you a communist?
I'm not a communist, Joe, not yet. But, you know, I think a few things. The first thing is that it is a little too early to say this is where the party is heading writ large. You know, you just mentioned Mike Lawler. He is going to compete against a Democratic centrist named Kate Conley, who is a special ops, decorated veteran, a West Point graduate, a formidable force, and not a member of the DSA. New York City, Richie Torres. You go over to New Jersey, Mikey Sherrill. Virginia, where you all are near, we have a governor. So, yeah, I think Michigan is the bigger test of this, and it's fascinating what you were just talking about, how those endorsements are spreading out. But the other part of this, and I think this is really important for people to think about is that we did see the DSA do very well, both for those endorsements from Mamdani and then, quite frankly, in the New York State Legislature as well. Here's one reason why. You have about 7% to 8% of turnout in New York City, which is deplorable for these primaries, very low. And who is turning out? A lot of young people. And I talk to them day on. And what do they say? Somebody yesterday just pointed me to this Wallet Hub study that was just released, where New York City ranked 182nd, the last city in the country in terms of entry-level jobs. Why? Because you cannot afford to live in New York City. So, you know, when we ask, oh, why are they voting this way? People are frustrated. And let's not forget, the president just decided not to sign a housing bill yesterday that could have eased up on that. So this is something that makes sense. They aren't voting this way because they're socialists or they're communists necessarily, or they want to abolish prisons. It's because they can't afford to live in New York City. And that's what's got to be addressed. And if the establishment Democrats aren't going to address it, they should vote for Democratic Socialists.
All I know is Mike Lawler didn't like it when you referred to his opponent as a centrist yesterday.
And I didn't say centrist. I said,
said
more moderate.
Yes,
I'm thinking there's a spectrum, a political spectrum here. There's the far left. There's the far right.
We're
moderate
always
in the middle.
Mike
if you're
Lawler.
Less far left, that makes you more toward the moderate direction. But I will say my piece.
I heard you.
Katie, on Jeannie's point about New York City not necessarily being the tell here, that a state like Michigan maybe will lead us to know more than New York City is that going to stop Republicans from tying Mamdani to national Democrats, even though he's not a president? He's not even a federal Democratic leader. He's a mayor.
It's an extremely high-profile figure within the Democratic Party and leading the largest Democratic city in the country. So, of course, Mamdani is going to be part of the conversation, because what we're going to see is New York is going to become a hub for testing the actual ability to govern like a Democratic Socialist. Do you remember what was the big slogan that Mamdani ran on? Free buses. What's happened since he was elected? Are the buses free yet? No, it's actually gone up to $3 instead of $2.90. Is the rent lower yet? No. Will it get lower? Probably not. He's talking about we're going to have city-run grocery stores. Those are many years away. So what we're seeing is, yes, there are frustrated young people, and that's actually a very interesting point Jeannie got on, because the largest demographic that vote for Democratic Socialists are young people. And you could say it's because there aren't entry-level jobs. I would counter it's because they're young, the frontal lobe probably hasn't fully developed yet, and they don't have other people in their lives that they're worried about. These are single people. They do not have children. But if we find a way to get these folks where they can have a good job, where they can get married, own a home, have kids, you know what's going to happen? They're all going to become Republicans, because, Tim, that all this data shows that if you are married and you have children, you're far more likely to be a Republican. That is the biggest indication of your party allegiance, is actually your marital status and how many kids you have. So here's the thing. We have young people who are frustrated that no one says anything's affordable. So both parties have to put forward their ideas. Here is what we're going to do to help you. And unfortunately, right now, young people are being swayed by a bunch of theater kids who are running for class president saying they're going to give you ice cream every day, but it's just not actually going to work. And the National Democratic Party isn't going to have to deal with that. Every single member of Congress is going to be asked if they support the positions of the DSA and if they support the positions of members of their own caucus. And when you have someone who's the nominee for Congress who wants to abolish prisons, not ICE, not defunding the police, abolish prisons. How far have we gotten away from the mainstream where the idea that there should be no prisons is actually being discussed in politics? When you don't think that someone who commits murder or someone who commits rape needs to be incarcerated, how can we take you seriously when we're discussing policy?
You said a lot there, Katie, and I'm just chuckling because I went to Emerson College. I ended up marrying a theater major. That whole thing is hysterical. But but hold that thought. Where's Jimmy McMillan when you need him, Jeannie? Because, yes, the rent is still too damn high. Wait, respond to what Katie said. Is the socialist promise a false one?
Yeah, Jimmy McMillan, he was a man ahead of his time. That still resonates. I remember it well. And yay for the theater kids. I was one as well as your wife. So there we go. You know, I don't think it is too much for young or elderly people or anybody in between to ask to have an affordable life. to be able to get married or not married, to be able to afford a home, to be able to have health care, to be able to do better and have their kids do better than they did, to be able to afford education. I mean, look at the cost of higher education. So, you know, all of these things are not sort of pie in the sky, I'm promising you ice cream and I'm, you know, running around as a theater kid. These are real issues that people are facing. When young people that I teach go to college and their parents pay $100,000, $200,000 for an education and they can't get an entry-level job, that is not America. We need to make the lives of our young people and our elderly people and middle-aged more affordable. And when you have a president, the leader of a party, whose party runs Washington, D.C., who says yesterday that housing costs are not a problem, this bill doesn't need to be signed, affordability is a Democratic hoax, I'm more interested in the reflecting pool, I'm more interested in the gold adornments on, you know, my ballroom. This is what people are hearing. And it's not just the Republican establishment, it's the Democratic establishment as well, because where we started, this is a Democrat on Democrat fight. And I, for one, think competition in both of these parties is a very good thing. Let voters have their say. Let them go to the polls and express what we're all feeling, which is our government has been run to the ground and is not working, and we need a change. I don't see anything wrong with that. I'm glad they're expressing themselves. And when you have people with clear ideas, if you don't like what they do when they get into office, you can vote them out if we have a fair electoral system, which gets us back to the Save America Vote Act.
Well, and just on that note of competition being good, there obviously, Katie, is an ongoing conversation around the primary system and whether or not the people who do turn out to vote in competitive primaries are the same type of voter that's going to turn out in the general election, or whether general election voters are enticed to turn out at all if they're getting potentially more extreme candidates on both sides.
Well, as someone who's run campaigns here for over a decade, I can tell you primary turnout is always one of the most frustrating things, because you will just go and knock on doors and spend all this millions of dollars to get 5, 7, 8, 15%, maybe on a good year, of the people to turn out. And it can always be frustrating. But usually what ends up happening is the people who show up in primaries are the ones that set the direction for the party. And that's what I would always argue to folks, is you have an outsized impact if you're willing to be one of those few people that will show up and vote in a primary. And what we're seeing is the young people who are showing up in these New York primaries, are they truly reflective of the Democratic Party at large? Unfortunately, what's going to end up happening is a lot of people have blind allegiance, and regardless of the policy, they're going to vote with there's all a right. D next to the name or there's an R next to the name. The real question is going to be the swing voter. First, who doesn't have strongly identify
always one is. Or another. Katie Frost and Jeannie Shanzano, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us here.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
One of the other big stories not getting enough coverage today, we mentioned it a bit earlier, is the supplemental. It finally dropped. Mm-hmm. We've been waiting a couple of months now for a supplemental budget request to pay for operations in Iran, knowing that $1.5 trillion budget request has been made for the Pentagon overall. This one we round up to $88 billion, Kaylee, to help cover the costs of the war, along with some other priorities. And it got the attention once again of Steve Ellis at the group Taxpayers for Common Sense, out with a blistering reaction here, in which it jumps off the page. About 6 weeks ago, he writes, the Pentagon put the cost of the Iran war at $29 billion. Here you see the statement on your screen. Now they want more than twice that. Steve Ellis says either the administration was not being honest about the cost then, or they're not being honest about the cost now. He is the force behind Taxpayers and with us in studio. Steve, it's great to see you. I fear that you might have an answer to that question. Do you? Or doesn't it matter?
It doesn't seem like there's any real numbers. I mean, as we said, they could They either were lying then or they're lying now. They can't. They don't add up. I mean, because you had $29 billion after more than 70 days of a shooting war, is what they estimated.
Yes.
Now you're a little bit more than 40 days later, and it's been mostly a ceasefire in there, and they're more than doubling the request. It's $67 billion is what they're asking for the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And in addition, when you add in backfilling for the Coast Guard and State Department, you're looking at $70 billion. So well over twice as much in a very short period of time. So mm-hmm. it doesn't add up.
Well, however they're doing the math over there, there is an argument that I would imagine the administration's going to make, which is this is necessary for the defense of the country. Should this spending really be considered that discretionary? Don't we need to restock our munitions and the like?
Well, Kaylee, you're absolutely right. We do. But the thing is that the Pentagon is awash in cash. Mm. I mean, it's not just the $1.5 trillion request this year. They got extra money in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act last summer, and they still have $100 billion of that money just sloshing around. Mm. So really what we're seeing is the Pentagon is trying to do a money grab any which way they can. So they asked for $250 billion more in their base budget, $350 billion more in another reconciliation package. Yep. And so now we're talking about another $67 billion. Yes. So they're just trying to figure out, get their finger in that appropriations pie however they can.
Well, of course, there's a lot more than defense in here. And I think the idea was to sweeten the pot for maybe get some more votes. Let's talk about what's really in here. $1.35 billion to fight the Ebola outbreak in Central Africa. A $500 million for the National Park Service to repair the World War II Memorial, which would hopefully go better than the reflecting pool. $10 billion in economic assistance to farmers. There's a farm bailout in this defense supplemental request, and more than $1 billion for Florida's agricultural sector. Kaylee, we find $1 billion to modernize Penn Station in New York City. I kind of hope that stays in there, to be honest with you. Steve, how does this all apply to defense?
It doesn't. And I mean, certainly there is a Christmas tree effect that happens on these. You start putting the adornments on there to try to get
it passed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, arguably, but then all of a sudden it starts attracting flies, too, or you start wondering, is this really necessary? And there's going to be criticism about it. I mean, you mentioned the ag bailout.
Yeah.
That they've gotten more than the ag sector's gotten more than $50 billion in bailouts over the last, or more than $60 billion in ag bailouts over the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. So this is just another one of this sort of money sloshing around that they're doing. There's other policy provisions in there too. They're trying to do year-round E15 for ethanol.
Yes.
They're just trying to sweeten the pot. Now, whether that actually gets it over the finish line is anybody's guess.
Uh-huh. Well, and it's a question as to whether or not this smaller in scale supplemental, although you obviously think this number maybe is too big, whether that can get over the finish line or whether you can still see a more than $300 billion reconciliation 3.0 bill, because they also have suggested the Pentagon should get more money through that. Of course, the House wants to attach the Save America Act to it too. Unclear how or whether that will be ruled as budgetary. If you're dealing with numbers of that size, there's going to be fiscal hawks in Congress who are going to want to see offsets. Mm. Are they going to be able to find them?
Well, we're coming up with a list of ways to cut the Pentagon's budget and cut spending, and we'll be out with that next week, actually, available at taxpayer.net. No, they're not going to be able to find those offsets readily available. I mean, this is really serious cuts that you would have to do. And so, I mean, most people think that reconciliation 3.0, the mm-hmm. third bite of the apple, that $350 billion for the Pentagon, is dead in the water. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be hard to get that level of support for something like that. They are not going to offset it for the most part. And so I'm feeling that that's why something like this supplemental, it gets some legs. Okay, mm-hmm. you don't want to give us the $350 billion. Well, how about the $67 billion? I mean, that's a fraction. Come on, Kaylee.
We're saving money all the time around here, Steve. The numbers turned out to be very different from what I was told, was the statement from Susan Collins, who chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee, which
kind of an important
sounds
person
like,
to know yes, what the numbers are supposed to be.
Sounds like taxpayers. You're either lying then or you're lying now. So let's back off a bit. You remind us we're, what, $40 trillion in debt. September's coming. No one's getting along. Midterm elections in November. We're cruising for a shutdown again, aren't we?
I don't know if either party has really got the appetite for a shutdown.
Yeah.
right before the election.
To vote for each other's priorities?
Well, no, I think it's more like the appetite for a continuing resolution. Okay. And you kick the can into the lame duck after the election, and then you deal with it. And then whoever's feeling their oats because of the election kind of is going to push. But I think that's more likely. The last shutdown was pretty bruising and extended, and I think it's still in voters' consciousness. So I don't think either party wants to be perceived as being responsible for that.
Well, and if it's a continuing resolution we end up with, could the Pentagon actually end up with even less money than they had requested for this fiscal year, ultimately?
Well, they still got a big boost last year. And, you know, I mean, they got a significant boost in the base budget. So they'll be fine. And not only that, at some point, they are presumably going to do the full year appropriations. And so they can survive on $1 trillion for a few months.
It's interesting. When we hear about, though, the need for a generational investment in the defense industrial base, is there enough money for that? Should that be a separate bill? Is this a wider conversation, or is it not true?
Well, for instance, and when you break down what this request was, there was about $2 billion in there for UAVs.
Yeah.
And so really what you've seen both in Ukraine and you've seen in Iran is that it's been less we need to spend on these exotic, expensive platforms, but that you want to have cheap and plentiful platforms, which presumably would be less costly than, you know, the sixth generation fighter.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I feel like it shouldn't be an and, it's a pivot. And it's a sort of recognizing we still need to have aircraft carriers and things like that, but we need to be making these investments in the smaller and less exotic and more replaceable items than, you know, an F-15 Eagle that we've lost several of them in Iran.
We're about out of time. We just have 30 seconds left. But the Speaker of the House is expected to be visiting the president at the White House just moments from now. What would you tell him about how he should be approaching these asks from the White House?
What Speaker Johnson should say to the president, or what I
would you say to the Speaker?
I would say that there is not an unlimited appetite for spending, and particularly in the Republican conference. And they've got a very small majority, so they need to be able to pick their fights.
All right, we'll leave it on that note. Steve Ellis, the president of Taxpayers for Common Sense, here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.